This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Okay, this is Matthew Sorens, Monday afternoon, track government and public policy.
I do want to briefly introduce our next speaker. As you know, this is a conference for both graduate students and faculty as well as professionals, so we wanted to kind of mix it up. So we've heard from a faculty presenter, so now we have a graduate student presenter, who I also have to say is a fine graduate of my program at Wheaton College, and I'm just so proud to know Matt. But let me just tell you a little bit about Matt. Matthew Sorens serves as a Board of Immigration Appeals accredited immigration counselor at World Relief of DuPage in Wheaton, Illinois. He is the co-author of a book that unfortunately is not downstairs because it hasn't come out yet, but I've read the manuscript. It's called Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, which he wrote with Jenny Wong with IVP, and it's fabulous. Prior to beginning his current work, Matthew worked with World Relief's local affiliate, a microfinance organization called
Las Pueblas en Acción Comunitaria.
In Nicaragua. He's a graduate of Wheaton College and is currently a graduate student at DePaul University's School of Public Service here in Chicago. Please welcome Matt Sorens.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about a different topic. Some of the themes might be related. We've talked about reconciliation and amnesty, and some of these same terms might come up in this discussion. But my case study is going to be on immigration in the United States context. So the good thing is everybody can agree that there's an immigration problem. In some way or another, we start to disagree almost as soon as we start to talk about what the problem is. And I put two examples here, which I think go to the two extremes of this debate on your handout. One of them is a flyer, a real flyer from a candidate for city council in Carpentersville, Illinois, which is only about an hour from here. You can see that on the left-hand side there. It says, "Are you tired of waiting to pay for your groceries while illegal aliens pay with food stamps and then go outside and get in a $40,000 car? Are you tired of paying taxes when illegal aliens pay none?" I'll go through some of these facts and fictions later. But are you tired of reading that another illegal alien was arrested for drug dealing? Are you tired of having to punch one for English? Are you tired of seeing multiple families in our homes? And so you kind of get the idea. It goes on. A very different perspective. There's a quotation here from Elvira Arellano, who was an undocumented immigrant who was deported about a year ago. But only after spending 1 year here in Chicago in a Methodist church. She says, "Out of fear and hatred of an enemy you cannot find, you have set out to destroy our lives and our families. As you knocked on my door, you are knocking on thousands of doors, ripping mothers and fathers away from their terrified children. You have a list of 17 million Social Security no-match numbers, and you are following that list as if they were terrorists and criminals instead of workers with families. You are denying us work and the seniority and benefits we have earned, and you are taking the property we have saved for and bought." So there you have two very different perspectives on what this problem is. And you'll find, or I've found at least, that those range of perspectives are very present within the church as well. Part of my work, I'll give you a little introduction to how I come into this. I'm not an immigrant. Most of my colleagues are either immigrants or second-generation immigrants, and they have more of a personal connection to this. But I work at World Relief DuPage, just west of here in the city, west of Chicago, as an immigration counselor. And I basically stumbled into that work. When I graduated from Wheaton, I wasn't planning on doing this. But I needed a job, and I spoke Spanish, and they needed someone who spoke Spanish, and it was working with churches to serve immigrants and refugees. It sounded okay to me. But I've become very interested in the policy debate through my work with World Relief. So my job as an immigration counselor is to let immigrants and refugees know what their options are under current immigration law, which has led me to a whole slew of questions as far as why are immigration laws the way that they are, how did we get here, what are the solutions to this problem that everybody seems to see some sort of problem. And beyond that, a lot of my neighbors where I live are immigrants and refugees, so it's become very personal to me as well. And I've tried to present this as sort of a clean case study. I definitely have some strong opinions. I'll try not to go into them too much. You can ask me about them later. But what I'd like to do today is just give you an idea of what the situation is with immigration in the United States, and a little bit of how we got there, how we've gotten to where we're at, and then look at Scripture to see how Scripture can inform the ways that we as individuals, as as churches and as the larger church, and as a society, as far as public policy, should think about this issue. And that's really what I'd like you to be thinking about as we go into discussion as well, is how do we respond to this challenge individually, as a church, if at all, and as society? What is a good and reasonable and just policy as far as immigration reform? So I want to start with just some basic facts about the immigration situation. And mostly, when we talk about the immigration problem, most people go quickly into the problem of people who are undocumented who are illegal. That's definitely the most contentious part of this debate. So that's mostly where I'm going to concentrate my time. Before I talk about who undocumented immigrants are, I think it's important to talk about who undocumented immigrants are not. Because there's a lot of misconception out there. And I get these sort of things in emails from my grandmother, who is a very sweet woman, but not necessarily always well informed. And I think that there's a lot of misconceptions. So I want to go through a few things which are common misconceptions. First, for example, undocumented immigrants are not causing an epidemic of leprosy. That was reported on CNN a couple years ago. Turns out that the facts were just, basically the statistics were just completely messed up. They did issue a retraction later, but not very wholeheartedly necessarily. Undocumented immigrants also do not comprise a third of our prison population in the United States. The reality is that foreign-born individuals, so they don't have good statistics for documented or undocumented immigrants, but immigrants as a whole are underrepresented in the prison system. That is to say, someone who is born in another country is less likely to be incarcerated than someone who is born in the United States in this country, as far as their share of the population. They do not account for 95% of the warrants for murder in Los Angeles, which is one of those emails that I've seen going around. There's a quote here from Chris Simcox, who founded the Minutemen organization, that undocumented immigrants, especially from Central America and Mexico in this case, are evil people who have no problem slitting your throat and taking your money or selling drugs to your kids or raping your daughter. So that's kind of the extreme of the rhetoric. But I think it's important to realize some of the realities. So I want to talk about who undocumented immigrants are based on the best statistical evidence that we have. And I should say, you all do research. Undocumented immigrants are a hard group to research because they're not the most eager people to answer surveys or to respond to telephone questionnaires. But I can only say that this research is mostly from the Pew Hispanic Center, which is a nonpartisan think tank. It's definitely consistent with my experience in DuPage County, Illinois, as far as the clients that I see, the stories that they tell me, the situations that I hear about. It's also important to mention that when we're talking about undocumented immigrants, 70% of immigrants, of the people who are foreign-born, are not undocumented. They're either naturalized U.S. citizens or have green cards, which is to say they're a lawful permanent resident. And I think it's important, as we focus on the undocumented, to not presume that every immigrant we meet is in that situation. But there are 11 to 12 million, probably, undocumented immigrants in the United States. That may have gone up, it may have gone down with the economic situation, but somewhere in that realm. Of those, about 45% entered lawfully, which means they had a visa. They came through either across the southern or northern border, or more likely through an airport, and entered entirely lawfully, but they overstayed. And I think this stereotypical image of an undocumented immigrant is not, usually that. Usually it's someone coming across the border, especially the Mexican border. That is about 55% of undocumented immigrants, but another 45% come in with a visa. And likewise, the stereotypical image is someone from Mexico. And a lot of undocumented folks are Mexican, about 56%. But that leaves a fairly large number who are not Mexican. And that includes a lot of Asian immigrants, a lot of European immigrants. I've had Canadian immigrants. I've had undocumented immigrants in my office from almost everywhere you can think of. Why do immigrants come to this country? Basically, immigrants come to this country for the same reasons they have always come to this country, which are economic advancement, probably the biggest one. As we were just talking about, most countries in this world do not have the economic situation that the United States has, even with our current crisis. We don't have much of a crisis compared to a lot of other parts of the world. Also, family reunification. And often what I find is the first person in the family comes for economic reasons, and then everybody else comes partially out of economic reasons, but also because it's not fun to have your family separated. For freedom in some cases, especially refugees or people who maybe don't get designated as refugees or asylees, but are fleeing some sort of political situation. And also for better opportunities for their children. One of my neighbors has a really terrible job that she doesn't get paid very well for, and I asked her once, you know, is this really that much better than what it was in Mexico? And she kind of thought about it. She decided it was, but she said, but it's not really about that. My kids are going to school, they're going to go to college, and the potential for change within one generation is so huge that for a lot of people it's more about their kids than it is about their own economic advancement. So another misconception, you read in the flyer from Carpentersville about immigrants not paying taxes. Some immigrants don't pay income taxes, although almost everybody's paying sales tax, paying property tax, either through their homeownership or through their rent indirectly. But 3 out of 4 undocumented immigrants actually do pay payroll taxes. Their money is taken out for state and federal income tax, for Social Security and Medicare, just like probably every one of you is taken out of their paycheck. How that works is most of the time they're using a false Social Security number. So they go apply for a job, they show a Social Security number that they bought on the street somewhere. I could tell you where in Chicago you could find one, but I'm not advising that as a legal counselor. And you show that Social Security card. Your employer gives you your first paycheck. They send some money onto the Social Security Administration and onto the IRS. The Social Security Administration will send them a letter back informing them that this is not a valid number, that it doesn't match this name or it doesn't match any name. They won't send the money back. That goes right into the Social Security coffers and is subsidizing my grandparents. But it's sort of this don't ask, don't tell policy from there on out, because most employers, if they're paying any attention, probably realize that Social Security number is not valid, but they don't really want to know, and there's any number of reasons that it might not be valid. Someone might have gotten married and not changed their last name. I don't know if there are any other reasons, actually, but 99.9% of those people don't have immigration legal status. But it's kind of a game where nobody asks questions, and except for in some states where you're not required to ask those questions. 1 in 3 undocumented immigrants live in what we call mixed status families, and most of the people that I see are in a mixed status family. Because the people who are just undocumented usually don't even bother to come to talk to me about options. But usually it's someone who has a spouse who's a U.S. citizen, or a child who's a U.S. citizen, or a parent who's a U.S. citizen who thinks that that's going to be able to help them. And in some cases it can, and many times it cannot. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But it complicates the situation substantially, because a lot of those U.S. citizen children or U.S. citizen spouses do not have nationality anywhere else. So if one part of the family is going to be deported, you can't necessarily bring the other part of the family with you. And undocumented immigrants, though you'll find here and there undocumented immigrants doing very well financially, for the most part, they're among the poorest people in our society. And some of that is because it's very hard to, you know, for one thing, most undocumented immigrants don't have a high degree of education coming in, but even if you do, it's very hard to get a really good job when you don't have a valid Social Security number. And they're also ineligible for pretty much all public benefits. So the only public benefits that you could consider them that undocumented immigrants are eligible would be public schooling through the 12th grade, fire and police protection, that sort of thing. But no welfare, no food stamps, no public housing. All those things are, in fact, most of those things are not options for legal immigrants for at least the first 5 years that they have their green card. So as I started to learn all this doing my work, I started to, you know, I hear this question all the time, well, why don't people just wait their turn in line? And I sort of wondered that too. That seems like a reasonable sort of thing, that people would go about things through the correct legal processes. So one of the first things you learn in immigration law is how you get a green card. And there's basically 4 processes for that. And this gets a little dry, but I think it's important to understand why we're in the situation that we're in today. The 4 processes are through refugee or asylee status, through employment-based immigration, through the diversity lottery, or through family-based immigration. So refugee or asylum basically is people who are fleeing persecution and have a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So we resettle a lot of refugees at World Relief, and many of them come from parts of Africa, from Burma right now, sometimes from Eastern Europe. But You'll notice I didn't say you could be fleeing poverty. You can't be fleeing an economic crisis. You can't be fleeing an environmental disaster. So it's a limited group of people, and I think it's a really great program and probably should be expanded. But it's not an option for most of the people who are here undocumented, who are coming from Mexico or Central America or the Philippines or India or South Korea. And it's also can be a slightly political process as well. So, for example, right now the only refugees we're getting from Latin America come from Cuba, here and there from Colombia. But during the 1980s, you had all sorts of people try to flee asylum from Central America, from Guatemala, from El Salvador, and very, very, very few of those applications were approved because while the government that was repressing people in Cuba is a government that our United States government has been opposing for 50 years or so now, the governments that were repressing people in some cases in certain Central American countries were often allied with the United States. And it was a Cold War thing, so that can be an issue as well in some cases. The second way that people would get status, legal status, would be through employment-based immigration. So you all, if you're not from the United States, might be good candidates for employment-based immigration. You're graduate students. You're probably going to have master's degrees or PhDs. Those are the type of people who get employment-based immigrant visas. You have to have a high degree of education or a highly specialized skill. So medical doctors, nurses, we take in a lot of nurses. But if you're coming to do what we would consider low-wage work, if you're going to work at McDonald's or cut lawns or take care of old people in a nursing home or do agricultural work, it's very, very unlikely that you would get an employment-based visa. There are a few specialized programs for agricultural work, but for the most part, that's not an option for most of the people who I know. It's also not an option if you entered unlawfully and then wanted to change your mind.
Is there like a lottery or a small percent that's allowed into a lottery system?
Yes, that's the third way, and I'll get to that. The diversity lottery is the third way. And they call that the diversity lottery because it is it's a lottery. You sign up over the internet, and last year one in 186 people won. You need to have a high school degree or 2 years of professional experience. And if you win, you get to come, you get to bring along your spouse and unmarried children under the age of 21. One in 186 is probably better than Powerball, but it's still not something to plan your life around. If you enter every year for most of your life, you probably will never win. And
I won after 5 years.
That's pretty good odds. if you want to give me a lottery number later. It's a diversity lottery. That part of the law was put in place in the early 90s to make our country more diverse. So the idea was we should bring in some immigrants from some underrepresented countries, so from countries that don't already send a lot of immigrants. So since that's the purpose, if you're coming from Mexico, from Poland, from Canada, from the Philippines, from most of Central America, from England, from India, from China, there is no diversity lottery. So if that is your national origin, you do not have that option. So for the stereotypical undocumented immigrant who comes from Mexico and does low-wage work, they're probably not going to get an employment-based visa, and practically guaranteed. They're not fleeing persecution, and there is no diversity lottery.
Is the number of these visas capped each year?
The number is capped each year. Quite
for all these categories?
Yeah, for all these categories. The refugee asylum, the asylum category is not necessarily capped, but the overall numbers are quite small comparatively. The refugee number is capped, but it's capped each year. It's not capped by statute. So it's not in the law, the number, but the president signs the determination. This year is 80,000. The diversity, family-based, and employment-based numbers are capped by statute, so within law passed by Congress, which, of course, Congress could change.
The employment-based immigration, we just had friends who had their PhD and master's from the University of Iowa, and they moved back to Asia because no employer would go through the process or the financial hassle. It actually costs the employers a lot of money.
It's extremely expensive.
So even though it sounds good, like if you have a job open, you can take someone from the country, but it's a huge legal hassle as well as financial expense for them. And these were people we loved, and we know God sent them somewhere else, but they tried for a couple of years.
Yeah, I don't mean to make it sound like it's easy if you do have the PhD. It's possible, maybe. If you don't, then there's not even a line to get in. But you always need an employer sponsor with employment-based immigration. So especially in this economy, nobody wants to offer you a job and pay a lawyer a lot of money. And like I do immigration law, but I don't do employment-based immigration because we were focused on family-based. So somebody's going to pay a lot of money to a lawyer. It's pretty complicated stuff. It's not certainly not easy. The last way, and the way that most of my clients who have status have gotten their status, is through family-based immigration. And that is basically if you're married to a U.S. citizen and you're outside the United States and have never been here unlawfully, and you haven't committed certain crimes, you don't have certain diseases such as HIV or tuberculosis, and you're not an alcoholic or mentally ill, you are probably going to be able to come to the United States, and probably in about a year or so, and it won't cost you more than about $1,000, not including any lawyer fees. But the married to the U.S. citizen is kind of the ideal case. Other situations are not so great. So if you are a lawful permanent resident, you've got your green card, and you're married to someone who wants to come to be with you because you're married, it's going to take at least 5 years, and in some cases 6 or 7 years, before that person would be eligible to come. And the reason for that is that those numbers are capped, and there's what they can call a preference system. So there's a different amount of time depending on what country you come from and depending on the relationship. The best, again, is like a U.S. citizen spouse, or if you have a U.S. citizen parent and you're under 21 and not married, or you have a U.S. citizen child who is over 21 and you've never been in the country unlawfully as the person who wants to come. The worst case scenario is you're a Filipino citizen and your brother is a U.S. citizen. Right now they're processing applications filed in 1986 for siblings of U.S. citizens from the Philippines. So some of you were not born in 1986. It was a long time ago. That's the worst case situation. Most are somewhere between 5 and 15 year waits. But it depends on the relationship and the country of origin. The Philippines is the worst. Mexico is the second worst. What determines that is, again, the law says that only 7% of immigrants each year can come from a given country. So there's a lot of Filipinos and a lot of Mexicans in the United States, and both for historical reasons as well as in Mexico for geographic reasons. But they get capped further off than other countries for that reason. Whether or not it's fair that Mexico has the same cap as, you know, Lithuania, I don't know. But that's the way the law is written.
Just to clarify, if you're married to a U.S. citizen but you have HIV, that's a basis for denial?
Yes. Sometimes waivers are possible, especially if they happen to be a refugee U.S. citizen. But although that was actually, HIV was specifically mentioned in the statute, and they took that out with the president's, the PEPFAR bill that was redone a couple months ago. But the administration has yet to implement that change in law.
In Miami, they'll pay you to marry them, some people, or then others, like, you can get married, but then, like, you don't know if for love or for...
That's definitely a huge problem, marriage fraud, because, you know, married to a U.S. citizen is the best way to go in certain senses. There's a huge problem with marriage fraud, and I've seen cases where I've told them, you know what, I don't think I feel comfortable doing this because, well, I don't usually tell them why, but usually because they don't speak the same language and the 30 years difference in age, and they get something very much. I've only done that one time, I think, but there's always, you know, most people who are married are not doing that, but immigration is very concerned about that, and rightly so. There have been many cases of that, and it's much easier to falsify a marriage relationship than to falsify a birth relationship, because if you got a birth certificate, you don't have to be a good parent, you're a parent, but to be spouses, you have to have what they call a bona fide marital relationship. So those are basically the ways that you get a green card, and I say all that because a lot of people who are here and out of status are in that process of waiting, you know, 15 years or something like that. But a lot of people don't have any one of those four ways to get status. So we can tell people to go wait in line, but there's actually no line to get in for a great number of people. And that's not always been the case historically. I think the other thing I hear a lot, and something I wondered a lot as I started doing this work is, well, why, you know, my great-grandparents came here legally, I think, you know, I presume. Why doesn't everybody else do it that way? And the short answer to that is there was basically no way to come here illegally before the 1880s. I mean, it was not always, you know, it could be a difficult journey and you go on a boat and all that, but once you get here, there was no laws that said certain people are excluded. That started in 1882 with the Chinese Exclusion Act, when you were excluded if you were Chinese. And there's lots of historical and political reasons for that, which are interesting. That exclusion widened by 1924, after the greatest wave of immigration through Ellis Island, which we've kind of romanticized in our history books. Well, it wasn't very popular at the time, because they were stealing jobs, and they were bringing diseases, and they were criminals, was the idea, which sounds a little familiar. But after 1924, you needed a visa to come to the United States. You never needed a visa before 1924. So, or 1922, there was a temporary act. But to the 1920s, there was no need for a visa, and you could be excluded for certain illnesses or insanity or things like that. But before the 1880s, there was no exclusions on the books. So that's basically the answer as why people why everybody else came the legal way. Question?
Yeah, so the four ways you said are ways to receive permanent legal status. Mm-hmm. What about temporary programs?
There are what you call non-immigrant visas, and those have fewer restrictions based on statute. So, for example, student visas, tourist visas, temporary worker programs. Those are, there's still caps on those sort of things in some cases, but those people are supposed to go back home. And again, a lot of those people turn into undocumented people at the point that their visa expires. It's also not easy to get those visas either, though. In some countries, it's very easy. If you're from Western Europe, you don't even need a visa anymore. You have what's called a visa waiver, most Western European countries and a few other countries. But if you're coming from pretty much anywhere in Latin America or Africa or most of Asia, you need a visa, and in some cases, a visa is practically impossible to get. When I lived in Nicaragua, people would they treat it like the lottery. They know they don't have a way to get a green card, so they try to get a tourist visa with the plan of overstaying, which the U.S. consulate keenly observes that and denies it every time. So people spend, but you pay $120 just for an appointment at the U.S. consulate, and you don't get that back if they deny you. So I made the mistake once of driving by the U.S. consulate and saying, like, wow, that's it. They're building a big new consulate in Managua. Like, wow, there's my tax dollars at work, building that huge embassy. And one of my friends is like, your tax dollars? That's every Nicaraguan who goes for a visa three times a year. And it made me a little embarrassed, but probably true. And there's a reason for that. They're trying to discourage people from applying for visas that they're probably not eligible for, because they probably are not planning to just visit. The hard thing is it makes it very difficult for someone who legitimately wants to just visit from a lot of those countries. So all that said, it sets up the situation we're in. And I don't say that necessarily to justify entering unlawfully, but I think it's important for people to understand where people are coming from. I want to look at where Scripture leads us real quickly. First, most of the main characters in Scripture are immigrants or refugees, if you think about it. From Abraham, who was going on a divine promise that he should follow God to this place. He had no idea where he was going. There's lots of refugees and asylum seekers in Scripture. Joseph was a victim of human trafficking, which is another kind of immigration that I don't have time to talk about. If you go through the Old Testament, a lot of those people fit that model of refugee or immigrant of one sort or another. Family-based immigrants like Ruth. Jesus himself was a refugee in Egypt. We don't know whether or not he applied for a visa before he went there.
Daniel.
What?
Daniel in Babylon?
It's
a student visa.
If you think about it, there's not a lot of characters in Scripture who stay in one place. A lot of them move around a lot. And I think because of that history, and certainly because of the history of the people of Israel as foreigners in a strange land of Egypt, there's a lot that the Scriptures have to say about immigration. Now, you're not going to find an endorsement for any particular Senate bill in the Scriptures, but there are general principles that I think, and this kind of goes to the political theologies that you guys talked about last night, but for me, these are principles that can inform the way we think about how we as individuals, as church, and as a nation should treat immigrants in our country. So, immigrants show up all the time, especially in the Old Testament. The Hebrew word for immigrant, and there's several different Hebrew words that could describe an immigrant. The word that I'm told, and I'm not a Greek scholar, but that a lot of scholars say is the closest to what we would think of as an immigrant is ger, which appears 92 times in the Old Testament. And that basically describes someone who's a foreigner, but who's not just a tourist, who's not just passing through. They're living for a time in a foreign country. So it's used both to describe the Israelites in Egypt, and later it's used to describe other people of other nationalities who were living inside of Israel. The bulk of what you read in the Old Testament goes something like Leviticus 19:33 and 34. When an alien lives with you in your land, do not mistreat him. The alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And Exodus 12:49, which is actually repeated four or five different times in almost the exact same words, it says, the same law applies to the native born and the alien living among you. So in a certain sense, immigrants or foreigners, strangers, were supposed to have the same legal, the same treatment as everybody else within within the society that God gave to Israel. But they're also singled out as people of special concern to God, often lumped together with widows and orphans. So, for example, Psalm 146:9, the Lord watches over the alien and sustains the fatherless and the widow, but he frustrates the ways of the wicked. And there was within the law that God gave to the Israelites, which may or may not have ever been implemented, but to me that's not necessarily relevant, there were special provisions to care for the economic needs of immigrants along with widows and orphans. There was, for example, when you read in the story of Ruth that she was gathering the gleanings, she was allowed to do that because she was a foreigner and she was also a widow, but so she maybe could do double. But widows and foreigners were allowed to go behind in the harvest and pick up what was left over after the harvesters did their first run through of the fields. And that was a special provision for people who were considered vulnerable. And the reason that a foreigner, a stranger, would be vulnerable in Israeli society is, for one thing, it was mostly an agricultural society, and most of the time land was inherited. So if you come in from somewhere else, you probably don't have land, and you're probably not going to get land. So this was a way to look out for this specially vulnerable group of people. The New Testament doesn't say quite as much about immigration, but it's there as well. Jesus says in Matthew 25, the famous goats and the sheep, it says, you know, I was a stranger and you welcomed me in. And, you know, a few verses later, I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. And the implication is, it's one of the most explicit references to hell that you find in the New Testament, is you should probably invite Jesus in. Likewise, in a more general sense, we have the story of the Good Samaritan, where Jesus is asked, you know, what is the greatest commandment? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Unless we think that, well, the neighbor, that's the person who lives right next to me, or within 1 square mile of me, or however we want to justify in our own mind who we have to treat nicely. Jesus tells a little story, and the story is about someone from a different culture, presumably, a Samaritan, who helps a migrant who's in need. Which isn't to say that your neighbor is only the migrant in need, but it certainly includes that person. So the bulk of Scripture, from my perspective, leads us to be generous towards immigrants, but that doesn't resolve some of the tricky issues in the policy debate. So there's a lot of concerns that we could reasonably have about immigration policy based on Scripture as well, and maybe some not based on Scripture, but that get thrown around a lot as well. For example, there's some people who are concerned that the more immigrants you let into the United States, it's bad for the environment, and immigrants living where they live tend to use very few resources relative to the United States. That's part of the appeal of coming here, is we live very well here in general. So if you keep people where they're at, they're not going to use as many resources, and the more people that come and live at the resource levels of the United States, the worse off it is for stewarding God's creation.
Who makes this argument?
I've read it in books.
No, there's a group called Numbers USA.
Yeah, if you look,
immigration group.
They're not environmentalists.
Well, some environmentalists. Yeah, some of the most.
No, there was a huge debate in the Sierra Club in the last couple years about what view to take on immigration.
Right, because a lot of the interestingly,
the Sierra Club is a overwhelmingly white woman.
Right.
Well, what about, there's environmental impact if they were staying where they were, too.
Well,
right.
I think the idea is, if you look at the amount of carbon dioxide emissions that a person in Mexico on average does versus what the amount of carbon dioxide emissions that a person in the United States does, people are emitting a lot less in Mexico and even less in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily subscribe to that argument, but what Kurt said about Numbers USA is really interesting. If you look at some of the people behind some of the most anti-illegal immigrant groups, we could say, and really anti-immigrant groups in general, they have pseudo-environmentalist motivations for a lot of their usually not Christian motivations necessarily, but environmentalist.
I mean, Numbers USA is also strong on population control.
And
issues like that.
Especially the people who don't look like us.
Another concern, which I think is more, in my mind, more legitimate, is the idea that we ought to be caring for the poor who are already in our midst as a society. So some people I've heard Christian scholars cite 1 Timothy 5:8, where Paul is telling Timothy about the care of widows, that a family ought to take care of the widow in their own family and not leave it to the church. So the argument is there's a priority of obligation there. You take care of your own first. Now, the other perspective would say, yes, but Paul was saying make sure all the widows get taken care of. He wasn't saying take care of your own widow and leave the other ones on the street. But that is, you know, there is some arguably scriptural basis for that idea. And the concern there would be if you're, and, you know, we could, our economist friend here could probably speak to this better than I can, but there's debate among economists as far as most economists agree that immigration, even undocumented immigration, is overall good for the U.S. economy. But if it hurts anybody, it probably hurts low-skilled workers who are native-born workers. So people who are more likely to compete for those jobs. Now, that's debatable, too. You know, George Borjas, who's, I think, at Harvard, seems to think very strongly that that does have a negative effect on native-born workers. A lot of other economists have said, well, not necessarily, and there's good research on both sides, and I'm not smart enough to figure out who's right.
So Borjas actually says what you said at first.
Borjas thinks that
he's part of the consensus, and you had it just right. Overall beneficial to average income, not beneficial to lower working poor.
Mm-hmm. Unskilled.
Right. And again, you can find a nice article that will tell you whatever you want to believe almost on that, on the question of unskilled workers. There's
more consensus than you think. The argument's over how big the
right.
effect
right.
is. The qualitative effects, you've got it this way.
Right. So that is, I think, legitimately a concern, especially from a Christian perspective. We don't want to be leaving people who are poor in our society, make them more poor by letting more people in. Also, and again, these go into things that may not be strictly scriptural based, but I think may or may not be legitimate. There's a lot of concern. These are the things you hear most often, even if I don't think these are necessarily the most biblical arguments. But you hear a lot of concern about national security. If we let all these people in, you know, aren't they all terrorists? Or, of course, they're not all terrorists, but one or two might be. And sometimes I think the best policy would be to have a very secure border, but you're not going to secure the border unless there's a legal mechanism for people to enter who are not coming to do bad things. But some people will say, well, if you just closed off the border altogether and built a big wall, then you wouldn't get any terrorists in the country.
But you said half are overstayed visas anyway.
Right, you'd have to not let anyone in come on a tourist visa either.
No tourists, no students.
Right. Technically, I don't think any terrorist that we're aware of has ever snuck into the border. I mean, as far as who have done terrorist acts in the United States, they tend to overstay student visas.
So just a point of clarification. So I study logistics of terrorism, actually. And the issue is not sort of have they, you know, it's true that sort of most of the terrorists that come here under false pretenses on legal visas, but there have been a number of occasions where they have tried to sneak over the Mexican border.
And the Canadian border.
And with smuggling sort of goods, in addition to smuggling people, they have to come over the border.
Right.
They don't smuggle it in.
Right.
So, I mean, there is sort of more than just saying, well, it's going to be terrorism.
Right.
Is there a logistical reason?
No, absolutely. And my thought is, the more legal mechanisms that you have for people to enter lawfully, nobody wants to spend 3 days crossing a desert and, you know, go with these really sketchy smuggler-type folks and pay tons of money, much more than you pay for a legal visa if you're eligible for visa. But they're not eligible for the legal visa. So that creates a system where so many people come across our borders and we don't know who they are. And I do agree, that's not a good situation for national security. It's not a good policy to have so many people coming in unlawfully. But how you deal with that question is what I'm going to let you guys talk about in a minute. One other concern, and this is, I think, probably, for me, this is the concern that I hear the most, and I don't necessarily think that there's any biblical basis for it. But there's a lot of concern about the decay of culture or the decay of cultural homogeneity, or, you know, why don't those people just learn English? And I hear that a lot, actually. I mean, talking to churches, and not, usually not quite that explicitly, though you can find things that explicit, but it's sort of like, well, they're not American, and they're not going to become American. So whether or not there's biblical basis for that argument, I don't know, but that's definitely a huge concern in a lot of people's minds. finally, I'd say the biggest concern comes not to this question of just immigration in general, but what you do with people who entered illegally. So this goes to the question, you know, we talked just a bit ago about amnesty in a different context. You hear the word amnesty thrown around in the immigration context all the time. There's one perspective says that basically if you let anyone who entered the country unlawfully stay here and never have legal status, that's amnesty. Others would say, well, not necessarily. If there's some sort of penalty being paid, it's, you know, amnesty comes from the word, the same root as amnesia, so it's like forgotten, this didn't happen. There could be a legalization that wouldn't necessarily be amnesty, because maybe you pay a fine, $500, $1,000, learning English, or paying back taxes for those who haven't paid taxes, whatever. There's a number of proposals on the table in that vein. But that's scripturally, there's a legitimate concern there. I think if you look at Romans 13, that's the verse that comes up most often in this context. And that's, you know, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, because the authorities that exist have been established by God, and those who disobey civil authority should expect judgment, because the government does not bear the sword for nothing. So the idea is the government is put in place by God, ordained by God to maintain order, and if we just ignore the laws that the government has set in place, how does that fit with Romans 13? Likewise, people hear Micah 6:8, and he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require to you, of you, but to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with their God. And I think a lot of people struggle with this tension of doing justice and loving mercy. Now, I think that we might want to reframe that question of what justice is, because like we talked about earlier, justice doesn't necessarily just mean criminal justice, but what is just, what is putting people into right relationships with God and with one another. But in a strictly criminal justice, you know, people feel like, well, we got to enforce the law, but these weren't people who were maliciously breaking the law. They had some reason for it, and maybe we're all a little bit complicit in it if we're benefiting from it economically, and people feel a tension there. So I think the important thing for me to keep on, you know, for you guys to think about as you guys begin your discussion is, what is justice in the context of immigration law? Keeping in mind, you know, I think it's intuitive to most of us that what the government says is not always absolutely just, and while we're commanded to submit to it, what does that mean? And, you know, what does that mean if you're living in Nazi Germany? And obviously I'm not comparing the situation with immigration to Nazi Germany, but clearly there are circumstances when laws are not just, and how do we deal with those situations? And is this a situation where the law is just or not? So I guess if we can break into discussion groups.
That would be great.
And I'd really like you to think about, I didn't write my questions down, but what should our response be as individuals? What's a good public policy as far as what government can do? And particularly, what is the church's role in this? If anything, does the church, you know, you have churches already responding in a range of ways. You have churches like the Methodist Church here in Chicago who will harbor undocumented immigrants in what they call the new sanctuary movement, which is mostly a public relations stunt because the government still has the legal authority to go in and take that person out. But they're not going to because they don't want that in the newspaper. On the other hand, you have churches which would definitely never say anything about this, and maybe some churches which will say that, you know what, you got to enforce the law and we should deport these people. So what is the role of the church in that?
Okay. Let's thank Matt for the presentation so far.